Bhagavate Vasudevaya. You have a very high seat here, and I feel a little awkward looking down at all of you. But if you'll all please bless me to speak, hopefully I will not interfere with the Bhagavatam's message. Today we're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, 6th canto, chapter 3, entitled Yamaraj Instructs His Messengers, and the text is number 9. Niyamanam tava deshad asma bir yatana grihan vyamochayan pataki. I'm sorry. Vyamochayan patakinam chitva pashan prasayate. We were bringing the most sinful Ajamil toward the hellish planets, following your order, when those beautiful persons from Siddhaloka forcibly cut the knots of the ropes with which we were arresting him. So please repeat after me. We were bringing the most sinful Ajamil toward the hellish planets, following your order. Srila Vishvanath Chakravarti Thakur remarks that the Yamadutas wanted to bring the Vishnudutas before Yamaraj. If Yamaraj could then have punished the Vishnudutas, the Yamadutas would have been satisfied. Om Gyanatimarandasya Gyananjana Niyamanam Tavadeshad Asambir Yatana Grihan Vyamochayan Patakinam Chitva Pasan Prasa Yate. We are bringing the most sinful Ajamil toward the hellish planets, following your order, when those beautiful persons from Siddhaloka forcibly cut the knots of the ropes with which we were arresting him. This is a very short commentary by Srila Prabhupada. But it reveals something. Actually, this pastime is very particularly important to all of us. The 5th canto discussed the hellish planets. And, of course, they're very frightening, what we hear there. And we hear that for the different sins that one commits in this world, we're brought to that place, and the sufferings that one endures there are described. And when Maharaj Parikshit heard these descriptions, he was feeling compassion for the people that would have to suffer those pains. And so the 6th canto begins with him asking Shukadeva Goswami, what can be done so that this can be avoided? And so then Shukadeva Goswami uses this pastime to help us understand how we can avoid that fate. And the remedy is the chanting of the Lord's holy name. And the potency of the holy name is what is glorified in this pastime. But there's more, too. There's always so much to learn in the Leelas in the Bhagavatam. So here we have an interesting situation. This commentary, Srila Prabhupada, I'll read the entire commentary because it's only 2 sentences, so I'll read it again. Prabhupada refers to Srila Vishvanath Chakravarti Thakur. So he says, Srila Vishvanath Chakravarti Thakur remarks that the Yamadutas wanted to bring the Vishnudutas before Yamaraj. If Yamaraj could then have punished the Vishnudutas, the Yamadutas would have been satisfied. So at one point, they were concerned with Ajamil being punished. Now, if they could just have the Vishnudutas punished, they would be satisfied. And it reveals something about their mentality. It's an interesting situation here, and it's instructive because we have 2 sets of servants. There's the Vishnudutas, and then there's the Yamadutas. So the Vishnu Dutas are the servants of Vishnu, as their name implies. The Yamadutas are the servants of Yama, Yamaraj. And who is Yamaraj a servant of? He is also a servant of Vishnu. So the Vishnu Dutas are Vishnu Dasa, and the Yamadutas are Vishnu Dasa Anudasa. So they're actually serving the same master, and they have the same purpose, but somehow there's a conflict between the two of them. And why is that conflict there? It's due to the lack of full knowledge of the Yamadutas. They actually have good knowledge. They understood that if a person commits the activities that Ajamila has done, then that person, for their own good, must be captured and taken before Yamaraj. And then Yamaraj determines the sentence that that person will have to endure. So the Yamadutas, they take pride in that work. It's in a sense, it's good work. It has to be done. And that knowledge of theirs that these people are sinful, that they must be taken to Lord Yamaraj for their own benefit, that's good knowledge. But their knowledge is not as complete as that of the Vishnu Dutas, who understood not only that Ajamila was sinful, but they also understood more. They had a higher knowledge. They had knowledge of the potency of the Lord's holy name. And therefore, when they both appeared on the scene at the same time, there was this confrontation. Although they both had the purpose of serving Lord Vishnu ultimately as the goal, they had a different understanding of how that was best to be done under this particular circumstance, and there's conflict. So much so that the Yamadutas, now they would like to actually see the Vishnu Dutas punished, even though what they're doing was perfectly proper. And not only that, not only were they what they were doing was proper, and not only was what they were doing also in the service of the same master that they were serving, but their knowledge was actually higher than their own. But they didn't recognize that. Even after hearing this very nice explanation of the potency of the holy name. That happened in the previous chapter, I believe. Is that correct? The Vishnu Dutas spoke already the glories of the holy name? Yeah. No. Yes? Yes, okay. Yeah, so they heard this very beautiful explanation, detailed analysis of the potency of the holy name, of how it was chanted by Ajamila, the particular state of mind in which he chanted that name, the potency of the holy name when it's chanted in that state of mind, and therefore why Ajamila was not to be taken by them, but was to be freed. And still, they were disturbed enough that they would have preferred at this point, if only they could have brought these Vishnu Dutas before Lord Yamaraj, and they could be punished for interfering with the service that they were doing. So there was some level of ignorance there. And it's instructive, I think, particularly for us, because we have a society, a large society. We're all serving the same master, but also we have conflict as well. And so we should try to analyze why does that conflict arise, and how do we best respond to that, or how can it be prevented, or if it comes up, how do we respond to it? Here we see that the Vishnu Dutas and the Yama Dutas, they had a different understanding of how to serve their master. And one had a deeper knowledge than the other. One group had a deeper understanding than the other. So even when we're serving the same master, these things happen. There's going to be differences of opinion about what's best to do, what the truth is. There's always, amongst different people, there'll be different perceptions of the truth, and it's based on many things. In our particular path, we're Vedantins, right? So when we want to determine what is evidence of what is truth, we turn to the Vedas. And so we're reading the same book as others, but they're interpreting it in a different way. So there's the personalists. The Vaishnavas have one understanding of how to understand the message of the Vedanta Sutra. And the Advaitins have another idea. They're reading the exact same book, but they have a very different idea. And we see that so clearly several times in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, where particularly where the Lord is speaking with Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya. And Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya is giving his lengthy explanation for 7 days, and the Lord is simply listening. And at a certain point, Sarvabhauma turns to him and says, I don't know if you're understanding what I'm saying or not, because you're not responding to what I'm saying. So please give me some indication. Do you understand what's being said? And he says, well, I understand the Vedanta Sutra, but I don't understand what you're talking about. So they're both reading the same book. They had a very different understanding of it. And then even within the Vaishnavas, sometimes amongst the Vaishnavas, there's different understandings amongst different groups. And then even if you come under one acharya, like we have come under Srila Prabhupada, still there'll be many different ideas or interpretations of how to best understand Srila Prabhupada's instructions and how to apply them according to different circumstances. And sometimes there may be conflict. There may be two different sides. And maybe one side is right and one side is wrong. Or maybe both sides are wrong. Or perhaps both sides are actually right, but although it still seems like there's a conflict. And one has to be very careful to very gently trod this path of dealing with other Vaishnavas in the common service of Srila Prabhupada. And I remember that once my Guru Maharaj, Srila Tamal Krishna Goswami, read to me a Vyasa Puja offering that he wrote. It's actually the last Vyasa Puja offering he wrote. And it was published in the 2001 Vyasa Puja book of Srila Prabhupada. And it dealt with this very subject. And I forget the full title of it, but the part of the title was, Who Speaks for Srila Prabhupada? So in other words, who can represent Srila Prabhupada? Who can speak for him? Now that he's not here with us physically, who has the credentials to actually speak for him and represent his actual intentions and his actual desires? And he didn't spell out who that person is or who those people are. But what he did in this Vyasa Puja offering was give some warning about how careful we should be when these type of conflicts arise. And he gave an example. He said that the truth can become like a many-headed hydra. And you all know what a hydra is. Like Kalia, right? A snake that has many different heads. And we may have the temptation to cut off those heads that we don't feel are actually true. But he said, we are not Srila Prabhupada, we're not Krishna, nor are we Srila Prabhupada. So we should be very careful before we condemn another. Otherwise, the next head that we cut off may be our own, he said. We have to be very careful. When we're serving with other devotees and we come across these type of conflicts, we have to understand that it's not that we shouldn't engage our discrimination and try to determine if something is right or wrong, or that we should accept some idea that, okay, everyone has their opinion and every opinion is equal. That's not how we've been ordered to analyze. But at the same time, we should be careful on a few fronts. One is that, is our understanding really fully deep? Have we really grasped the message as deeply as another? And another point is, even if someone's point of view may be incorrect, it's not reason to condemn them. We may disagree, but we shouldn't condemn. And that is where we have to be very careful. I once heard from Srila Naranjan Maharaj what I felt was a very important instruction. Because we see that sometimes devotees fight. They come to a difference of opinion. They see the other person's point of view is wrong. And then it becomes an issue by where they fight, and actually they become enemies of one another, which is actually almost comical in one sense. Right? It's actually very sad on one level, but in another sense it's almost something to laugh about. It's foolish that two people that are have the same purpose become enemies of one another. And his advice or instruction was that never break a relationship with another devotee. In other words, we may disagree with them, but we can find a way to say, Prabhu, you have that point of view, I have another point of view. We obviously disagree, and apparently through conversation we haven't been able to reach some some similar point of view. All right, let's leave it there and let's still remain friends. We may disagree. Even you may condemn me, but I still won't break my relationship with you. And in English, we have a phrase, burning of a bridge. I don't know if they have a similar Hindi or Indian phrase like that. When you break a relationship with someone, they call it burning a bridge. Because when you burn, when you cross a bridge, often this is done in times of war. You cross a bridge and you don't want the other side to be able to cross the river, so you burn the bridge. And then you're separated for good, or it becomes very difficult to cross. So in relationships with other devotees, we should try never to burn that bridge. We should leave the bridge intact. I may be on one side of the bridge, you may be on the other side. Let's leave the bridge there so in the future perhaps we can come together. Because perhaps my point of view will change, perhaps your point of view will change, perhaps both of our points of view will change. And we may have, in the future, we may come to an understanding that now I see why that devotee reacted the way they did to that circumstance. And at the time, I couldn't understand why they did and seemed very wrong to me. And now I understand a bit more. Maybe I've experienced something in my own life similar, or maybe somehow by some mercy I've been granted the ability to see something from this other person's point of view. But now I can understand why they behaved the way they did, why they reacted the way they did, or why they saw a situation in a particular light that I couldn't see it in. So by not burning that bridge, we allow that possibility to happen. Or we also allow the person, say we're right and the other person's wrong. We allow the ability for that person to recognize how their point of view is wrong and to join us in the correct point of view. Because if we burn that bridge, it makes it very difficult for them to cross that bridge to our side. So there are different perceptions. And it's based on knowledge. The Vishnu Dutas had this higher knowledge. They're situated in the mode of goodness. And Bhagavad Gita instructs us that Satvat Sanjayate Jnanam, that from the mode of goodness that this knowledge arises. And with knowledge we can begin to perceive things clearly. And when the world isn't black and white, but there are these gray tones of truth, we can more expertly understand what is right and what is wrong, have the ability to do so. Bhagavad Gita also tells us, it describes how people that are learned or people that are capable of seeing the truth, how they view this world in a very different way from others. Right? There's this in the fourth chapter, Yehi samsparsha ja bhoga, dukha yonaya evate, ariyanta vanta konteya, nateshu ramate buddha. That the Buddha, the people that have this ability to discriminate, that they look at this world in a way, they see it in a very different way. And that is what actually Buddha Yoga is all about. We read about, particularly in the second chapter, the verses from the 40s through the 50s and 60s, we hear this, Krishna repeats this Buddha Yoga, Buddha Yoga, Buddha Yoga, again and again. That this Buddha Yoga is not a different form of yoga, but it's an application of the intelligence that's applied in different forms of yoga. Whether one's performing karma yoga or whether one's performing bhakti yoga, one has to be to engage Buddha Yoga, which means through one's intelligence, we analyze the data that we receive through our senses in such a way that it's beneficial for our liberation rather than it acts towards our further bondage. Right? So our eyes see images and our ears hear sounds and our other senses take in different data, different information. And one person without this ability of Buddha Yoga, these sense objects they see as something that can be engaged for their own pleasure, for the pleasure of their senses. Whereas the Buddha yogi takes in the same data, but when it enters the brain, it's analyzed in a completely different way. And it's seen as what it is in truth, in reality. That perhaps it's seen as a danger, or perhaps it's seen as, as in that verse is stated, yehi samsparsha jaboga tuka yona yevate, that what's seen as a source of pleasure is actually understood to be the source of misery. One person is saying, I can derive such pleasure from that object. And another person is saying, that object, even I may get some sensual pleasure from it, actually will cause me suffering rather than happiness. So better to avoid. And that's called Buddha Yoga. That is knowledge in action. So when we come to Krishna consciousness, we learn how to regulate the senses to some degree. But with a little knowledge, often pride develops as well. Like the Yamadutas we see, they had some knowledge, they had some good knowledge, but they didn't have complete knowledge. And that knowledge now has them wishing that the very good servants, actually the superior servants, the better servants, they're wishing for their suffering, which is so contrary to their purpose and actually so unbeneficial for themselves. So, so we come to Krishna consciousness, we make some advancement and we control the senses. But if some pride develops because of that, there's some external renunciation. But if pride develops because of the external renunciation, we never actually become deeply internally renounced, because that pride will block that. And it's only when we become deeply renounced and we become free of the desire for name and the desire for fame and the desire for glory, pride and so on, then we can actually begin to see reality. But these same things are blocking our clear perception. Right? Throughout the Bhagavad Gita, actually, it's not only Bhagavad Gita. For instance, Brahma Samhita describes Advaitam Achutam Anadam Anantarupam Adyam Purana Purusham Navyovanam Cha Vedeshu Durlabam Adurlabam Atma Bhaktau Govindam Adipurusham Tamaham Bhajami. That Vedeshu Durlabam, it says, I worship the primeval Lord Govinda, who's not understood through the Vedas, but is understood through the pure devotion of the heart. Right? So the information is there in the Vedas. Anyone can read it. Some people are reading it and understanding it, and some people are reading it and entirely misunderstanding it. Some people are reading it and becoming transformed by it. And other people are reading it and either being entertained by it or just gaining some academic knowledge from it, but not actually deeply understanding it or being transformed by it. And we find that in the Bhagavad Gita as well. In the fourth chapter, Krishna begins to speak about transcendental knowledge. And he says, I'm going to reveal this knowledge to you now, Arjuna. Why to Arjuna? Bhakto seme sakha cheti rahasyam hetadutamam. Because you're my devotee and you're my friend. Right? Otherwise, this knowledge is rahasya. It's secret. It's hidden. But why can you understand this message? Even it's become lost in time. You have the ability to understand it, not because you have a very powerful brain, right? Not because you're born in a particular family, or particular circumstances. You can understand it because you're my bhakta and you're my sakha. You're my devotee and you're my friend. And it's that, what is a devotee and what is a friend? It's someone that doesn't have let their own selfish interests interfere with their relationship. Right? They become selfless. When you have a relationship with a friend and there's some love there, then that love means, as Krishnadas Kaviraj describes in Chaitanya Charitamrita, that their happiness is actually more important to you than your own happiness. Right? So that's how one has love with a friend or some devotion. It means that there's no selfishness interfering in that. And it's the selflessness which becomes the conduit for that knowledge to actually arise, true knowledge, right? Not just academic knowledge, but a deep understanding. Actually, Krishna will describe in later chapters, 13th chapter, I believe. He says, what is actual knowledge? It's knowledge of three things. Knowledge of the soul, knowledge of the super soul, knowledge of the material nature. Nature, and joy, and consciousness. If we understand these three, that's actual knowledge. And knowledge of so many other things, memorization of facts and knowledge of books and so much information that's out there, that's one type of knowledge, but that's not what, when Krishna is speaking of knowledge, that's not what he's speaking of. He's speaking of understanding this world for what it is, seeing it for what it is, the material nature, and understanding who we are, who Krishna is, and the relationship between all these three. You understand that, then you actually know. You know what is real and what is not real. And to understand that, we have to be free of selfish desires. And when we become free of that, we can see clearly. That knowledge will be illuminated in us. So, tesham satata yuktanam, bhajatam pratipurvakam, tadami buddhi yogam tam, again buddhi yogam tam, yenam amupyantate, then we can come to Krishna. When we're constantly devoted to serving Krishna with love, right? Again, that's the qualification. It's our attitude toward Krishna. When we have such love for Krishna that we don't want anything but to serve Krishna, then tadami, he gives it. He gives buddhi yoga, the ability to discriminate clearly, to see clearly, to understand clearly. That when we pick up the books and read them, that not just the words enter our eyes and leave some small impression on the brain and then they're forgotten, but actually the message that the words are meant to carry is carried through our eyes and into our consciousness and deep within the heart. Then we become transformed. And then it becomes possible for us to truly serve our master. Right? Then we can become that expert servant, which is really what our goal is. Prabhupada would instruct us, he said, there are three different types of servants. Right? There's third class, who you instruct them what to do and they don't do it. Or if they do it, they do it begrudgingly. They do it without the proper attitude. Second class is a good servant. You tell them what to do, they'll do it. And the first class disciple will do what you want them to do without you having to tell them. It means they've understood to some degree the desire of their guru and they've taken it to heart. They've been transformed. It means now their own selfish motivations and desires for either comfort or fame or whatever might interfere has been removed. And so now it's the message is speaking to them clearly and they're understanding deeply what needs to be done. And we see Srila Prabhupada, of course, is the prime example of that. Because amongst so many godbrothers and so many very qualified godbrothers, somehow in Srila Prabhupada's heart, the desire of his guru became so brightly illuminated that he was able to do such phenomenal feats of service for his guru. So to some degree, we want to become like that. And to do so, we have to carefully remove the anarthas that are preventing us from perceiving this world clearly. There's at the beginning of the Bhagavatam, the setting of its speaking is taking place, and the sages are gathered there in Naimisharanya. And they turn to Suta Goswami, and they ask him to please speak. And they describe why. And they say, one, you're free of all vice. You understand the word vice? It means anarthas, more or less. Yeah, vice. And because you're submissive to your guru, they bestowed upon you all the favors that a guru grants upon a gentle disciple, they say. And therefore, you have the ability to share all of the knowledge and the science that you gain from them with us. And it's Prabhupada translates that in a very nice way. He says, all the favors granted upon a gentle disciple. So what does a gentle mean? I mean, that's something worth thinking deeply about. That someone that's gentle means they're sensitive, right? Someone that's rough, they take something very delicate and they don't handle it properly and it becomes damaged in some way. Someone that's gentle understands how precious something is, how sacred something is, like the message of the Guru, or the message of the Bhagavatam, how precious and sacred that message is. And they handle it with care. And they also understand how precious the Vaishnavas are, and they handle them with care. And so such a sensitive person, when the message is given, spoken from guru to disciple, that gentle disciple receives so much more from the guru. Even two disciples are sitting in front of the same guru and the guru is speaking. But for one of them, the message is becoming illuminated. Another, it may not be, or maybe to a much lesser degree. And actually, that's how Dibya Gyan is transmitted. It depends on the qualification of the recipient. Both have to be there. And Srila Prabhupada gave this example that just like if a man and a woman want to conceive a child, the man has to be potent, the woman has to be fertile. And if they're both qualified in this way, then through their union, a child is born. And he used this as an analogy to understand the relationship between the guru and the disciple. If the guru is bona fide, proper representative, and if the disciple has the proper qualifications of a disciple, and there are many, right? But now let's talk about this selfless attitude of service. Let's say that's primary. Then, and as the sages describe, a gentle disciple, free of vices, then that person can receive the message and receive Dibya Gyan. And actually our whole process works that way. The whole process of bhakti works that way. Just like you take this verse, Nama Chintamani Krishna's Chaitanya Rasa Vigraha, Shudapurna Nitya Mukta Binavan Nama Namino, that the holy name is completely pure, right? Shudapurna, it's eternally liberated, right? The holy name is pure and powerful. Therefore, when we come into contact with it, we should be transformed. Some of us become transformed and some of us don't. Or we become transformed in different degrees. So why is that? It's not because the name is different. It's because the recipient is different, right? The sun is always bright and powerful. Some people are sitting under the clouds and some people are not under the clouds. The one that aren't under the clouds are going to receive the powerful effect of the sun's rays. And those that are under the clouds, it's going to be diminished by that. So the holy name is powerful. And in the form of the Lord in the Archivigraha is powerful, all powerful, completely powerful. And the Lord manifests in his name, in the Didi, in the Bhagavatam, in the Vaishnavas, in the holy rivers, in so many places the Lord is present. And we expose ourselves to the Lord in these various forms. But it's only according to how qualified we are to receive that mercy that determines how much we become transformed by it. And the point is that we become transformed by it. So that's where the work is meant to be done, in actually preparing ourselves to become recipients of the Lord's mercy. Then we'll become transformed. I had been contemplating this point a lot, actually, because I was reading one book that was describing a lot about the holy name and the powers of the holy name. And we know there are warnings there about that we can chant for many, many years. Where's the Bahu? Was it the verse? Bahu, no? I'm forgetting. Bahu, Shari. Yeah. Pari Krishna, Pari Premadana. That we may chant for many lifetimes and not receive the full effect, the desired effect of chanting the holy name until we become proper recipients. It's not that the Yamadutas were bad, but their lack of knowledge interfered with their becoming better servants of the Lord. And we look at the example of the Vishnu Dutas and how perfect their service was, how they understood clearly. And we can take inspiration from that. One of the most inspiring parts of the Ramayana for me was when Hanuman meets Lord Ram. And who's who is the servant that the monkeys that Hanuman is the servant of? Sugriva. Okay, so Sugriva has seen Ram and Lakshman arrive, and he's very nervous. He sees them and he's saying, "I don't know who these two are, but they look very powerful. Maybe they're sent by my brother to kill me." So he sends his most trusted servant, right, Hanuman, to go and determine who are these people and find out what they are. And if they'll be our friends, then bring them into our side. And if they're enemies, then we need to know, and we need to know how to deal with it. So it's a very sensitive and difficult service, not an easy one. And then Hanuman goes down and meets them, and not only does he find out who Ram and Lakshman are and what their purpose in being in that place is, but he speaks to them in such an expert way. His words, Ram is glorifying him and saying, the way that this Hanuman speaks, his words are so pleasing and so perfectly composed that it's just changing my heart, and I become very endeared towards him. And he not only determines the information that Sugriv needed, but through his actions as a expert disciple, he gains them into Sugriv's camp to serve Sugriv's purposes as well. And I just thought that's such a beautiful and instructive pastime. And we see just how selfless and perfect Hanuman was in that. And it reminds me of some experience I had with my own Guru Maharaj. I may have told this story here before, but I may not have, so I'll tell it in any case. And it's a good instruction to hear in any case. But I often felt that he had so much experience with Srila Prabhupada personally, that I felt he gained a lot of insight into what it means, what a guru is and what a disciple is, and how they react to each other and how they behave toward each other. And he liked to share that. He wanted his disciples to get the opportunity to experience what he experienced with Srila Prabhupada as far as possible. So he took every day parts of life, everyday occurrences in life, and use them as an opportunity to instruct a disciple. And I used to stay with him regularly in Vrindavan, and some of you may know the little house that he stayed in, not far from the Krishna Balaram temple, just around the corner. And every morning, he would have his disciples cook, and he would invite his godbrothers to come and take prasad, every morning and every afternoon, actually. And it was actually a very wonderful time to spend. There'd be such elevated godbrothers there, and it would be very pleasing and very instructive to see how they would behave and hear the discussions that they would have. But at the same time, my responsibility was I would have to serve the meal, and it could be very also instructive. You could receive a lot of instruction, and it could often be painful instruction, but still very valuable. But I remember one morning, he asked, I was staying in this home with him, and another godbrother of mine was staying also there. And he asked my godbrother to go invite the different godbrothers that he wanted to have prasad with that morning. And one of them was Dhanadhar Swami. And so this godbrother went and asked the different godbrothers, came back, and he said to me that this one is coming, this one is coming, Dhanadhar Swami is not coming, and this one is coming also. So Gurudev asks, you can tell him that. So then later, my guru did ask me, who's coming? And I told him. He said, what about Dhanadhar Swami? I said, he's not coming. He said, why not? I said, I don't know. And then he started to really give me very heavy instructions in a mood, very strong mood, let's say. He had a power to just stare at you. Just by his very heavy glance, you felt like a 2-ton weight has been placed on your chest, you know. And he said, this is the problem with you disciples. He said, you're just like peons. You understand what a peon is? A peon is a servant, But a peon doesn't have a brain of their own. A peon just does what you tell them to do. You say, go do this, and all they know is do what you told them to do, and then they come back and do it. So he said, you're like peons. You don't actually have any, you haven't taken the desire of your guru as your own. Now, on one hand, I'm sitting here saying, I wasn't the one that was asked to go find these people. That was someone else. But I also knew better not to, always better just to accept what's coming, and it's purifying, and it's actually a greater disservice to say it wasn't me than to, you'd get more heat for saying that and trying to defend yourself in any way. So he said, the problem with you is you're like peons. You haven't accepted your guru's desire as your own. So therefore, he said, if you wanted Dhanadhara Swami to come to this meal as much as I did, he would be here having breakfast with me. So now you should go find him and make sure he comes here. Yeah. So I said, okay, I'll do that. So I went and I met Dhanadhara Swami and I begged him to please come. My Guru Maharaj so much wants you to come. And he agreed to come. But I always thought that that was very important. And there was another time, a similar time, where I was also staying in Vrindavan, but I was staying with another sannyasi. I was staying with Gunagrahi Swami. And my guru at that time was staying in the same home that he was staying in. And at one point, my guru said to me, Gunagrahi Maharaj says you're serving him nicely. And I said, well, Gunagrahi Maharaj is very easily pleased. And then my guru told me something. And of course, you know, amongst his disciples and amongst so many, it was always thought that he was a very difficult person to please, my Guru Maharaj. That no matter what you did and how hard you tried, there was always something wrong, even in some small detail. And he was going to find that detail and he was going to make you understand just how much your service was lacking. And so I said to him, Gunagrahi Maharaj is easy to please. And he said, yes, I'm also very easy to please. He said, you just have to have the right disposition. Do you know the word disposition? It means you have to have the right state of mind, the right attitude, in a sense. If you have the right state of mind when you're dealing with me, then I'm also easy to please. And I thought about that many times as I was serving. That even it may not show externally that he was pleased. If your disposition was right, if your attitude was right, somehow he was pleased. So, if our attitude is right and if our disposition is right towards the Guru and towards Krishna, if we're non-envious and if we approach Krishna and Guru with devotion, then the message that they have will reach us, and it will change our heart. It's that disposition in ourselves that has to change. As long as there's something in our disposition that is separate from that, than the desire of our guru, the desire of Krishna, we'll be unable to understand properly how to serve the guru and how to serve Krishna. And then, based on that, when God brothers or Vaishnavas come together, all with the same purpose to serve, there'll be so much conflict. And then if our disposition is wrong, that conflict will become the stimulus for breaking up of the society. Whereas if we can have the proper disposition, real clear perception will be granted to us. And even if others disagree with us, we'll deal with them in such a way that ultimately Krishna's purpose will be served in the long run. And I'll give one example. Before I give the example, I just want to say that, again, I feel unqualified to sit before all of you and speak and instruct in any way, because I see that the devotees here are actually the best example in our society of understanding Shastra clearly, understanding the disposition of a Vaishnava clearly, and understanding how to cooperate to serve nicely. So thank you very much.